This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Niko Skivoski never aimed for the biggest job at the biggest company. He focused on something more nuanced, adding value in the world. That goal led him to create a book that illustrates some of the more bizarre medical diagnostic codes, launch a co-working space, and start Redox, which operates a platform that aids development and distribution of healthcare software. Since Niko founded Redox with Luke Bonney and James Lloyd in 2014, it has grown to almost 200 employees and raised nearly $100 million. Niko, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Thanks for having me.
You got a graduate degree in economics from Boston University, and then you were hired by Epic Systems, the Madison electronic medical records company. What did you do at Epic?
Yeah, I had a pretty interesting trajectory there. So I started as a pricing analyst, which I figured that fit with my degree a bit. But about a month in, I realized that much of the job could be automated. So I set out to do that. And with that excess capacity, I ended up getting transferred to work for Epic's CTO, which led me to kind of tackle problems at the company from an executive level, which I thought was really interesting. And I really loved that opportunity there. So less than a year into my role at Epic, I had tons of authority that I hadn't really earned. And people were like, who's this guy? So I actually ended up working with a lot of intrapreneurs within the company, people who are trying to solve problems outside of their day jobs and get new initiatives off the ground and create value for customers and employees. So that's what I spent most of my time there doing, was kind of rallying these innovative folks and trying to help them solve more problems for the company.
So one of the technologies that you developed there was kind of a question and answer technology for capturing what people are thinking before they leave a company. A great kind of way to solve the problem of attrition, right, or turnover. But tell about how you left Epic to think about that technology.
Yeah. So what we started was, it was kind of like Quora or Yahoo Answers, where someone could post a question and other people can answer it. And the idea was, there's all this knowledge in people's brains. How do we actually get it out in a way that's more searchable and more usable? And so I launched that at Epic, and it was called Beetlejuice there. And it got a lot of traction. And my idea was to have Epic roll it out to their customers and to the wider healthcare technology ecosystem so people can better collaborate. But, you know, based on what Epic was focused on, that wasn't something that they were going to do. So I was like, heck, maybe I should leave the company and actually do that on my own. And in contemplating that decision, I was talking to a friend and he said, well, what's the worst that could happen? Literally, if the business fails, you either come back to work at Epic or you get another job. And I was like, oh, I love getting jobs. I could do that. So the worst case scenario didn't actually sound so bad. And so I took the leap and quit to start Breadcrumbs.
So then you got into like playing out what the worst case scenario could be in some sense, right? Because you ended up calling it Breadcrumbs, and you had a deal to have Breadcrumbs acquired that fell through. So you ended up licensing the software. So you had no job and no money. What'd you do? You thought about getting a job.
Yeah. Well, so it was like 4 months into the startup, and we thought we were going to be acquired by one of the Epic consulting companies in the ecosystem, which made a lot of sense. And yeah, as you alluded to, the deal didn't end up going through. And the founder of the company that was going to acquire us, who's a great entrepreneur, he now runs a VC fund. He sat down with me and I was like, hey, you know, I'm probably gonna have to get another job. So maybe I could come work for you. And what he said was, you know, you could come work for me, but I don't think that's the best place in the ecosystem for you. That's not where the world's gonna get as much value as they could from you as an entrepreneur. So he said, like, what's holding you back from starting another company? And I was like, well, I don't have any more money and I'm running out of runway and I need to pay rent. And he said, well, how much money do you need? I will literally pay your bills until you get something else off the ground. And I was shocked just by, well, first off, just the generosity of that, but also just the belief that he had in me to start another company. And I didn't end up having to hit him up for that money, but I did end up starting 100 Stay at the co-working space, which he sponsored. I started Vote Mostly Online, which he funded. I started that book you alluded to, which his company was one of the biggest customers of, and then eventually Redox, which he led our angel round of investment. And so this by far was the probably the most impactful support that I had as a young entrepreneur. And I think if I didn't have that support along the way, I would be, you know, some vice president of something at a company right now, not actually creating the company that I had.
Well, it says something about you that you didn't take the money and run, that you wanted to do something, right? And we should say that the guy you're talking about is Mark Bakken, who now runs HealthX Ventures. Got to do a shout out to him, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Mark. We call him Uncle Mark.
Sounds reasonable.
It makes sense.
So that book is so amazing. That's where I first heard about you. The book is called Struck by an Orca. Tell us about the book. It's just such a unique proposition for a book.
Yeah. This was when I was, I was running this co-working space, and there was a lot of people starting different companies and us just sort of at a meta level learning about company creation. And I was studying the Lean Startup methodology, which is, you know, a very popular way of getting from zero to one. And I needed a project to focus on because I learn best by doing. So I read the book and then I was like, I gotta try this out. And the idea that we had was to create a coloring book that illustrated medical diagnosis codes that the healthcare industry at the time was going from version 9 to version 10 of ICD codes, International Classification of Disease. This is essentially how doctors communicate with insurance companies and tell them how people got injured. So the idea was, let's take some of these funny codes, and like Struck by Orca was one of those codes, and illustrate them in a coloring book and people could color them. But the Lean Startup methodology says, okay, that's your hypothesis, but what does the market tell you? And so what I did, our minimum viable product, the MVP for this company, was not a book itself. It was a website describing the concept of the book with a button to buy it for $25. And I put it out there and I sent it out on LinkedIn and actually had like 3 people buy it. And I reached out to them and had a set up calls to do customer discovery interviews. This is all part of that Lean Startup methodology. And realized that they bought the book as a gift for their customers. These were like Epic people, so healthcare systems. And they wanted to give it as a gift. And they didn't realize it was a coloring book. They thought it was an art book. And so through the feedback from the market, this project turned into an art book, which is more like something you'd set on your coffee table and peruse, and a satirical art book rather than a coloring book. And as I talked to more customers and validated that idea, got more confidence in the business, was able to collaborate with artists. So I crowdsourced art from the art community. And we filled up a book of about 70 different ICD-10 codes, including Struck by Orca. There was also Burned Due to Water Skis on Fire, or Struck by a Falling Object on a Merchant Ship. Like these crazy things that, you know, apparently have happened to people, and they got insurance, health insurance claims because of it. But we had our artists illustrate it and turned that into a book. I printed it over at Alpha Graphics on King Street in Madison, and we launched it. It ended up selling more than 10,000 copies, went through 10 prints of the first edition, turned it into a publishing company and created other products around it, and ended up selling that publishing company about 3.5 years ago now. So it was a fascinating little company. And it's funny because it was probably until like maybe 2 years into Redox that Redox's revenue surpassed the revenue of this silly publishing company that I had started. But what it did was it really whet my appetite for the Lean Startup methodology, and it showed that it worked and gave me a lot of momentum and some revenue that I could fund my life with as I started other companies in the space.
So then, you know, you kept getting more serious. You were growing 100 State, the co-working space, and you thought there was potential there. But you and your friends saw that a lot of startups needed interfaces to share their data with health systems. You were debating between those two things, which one to grow. How did you land on the interface idea, or what became Redox?
Yeah, for sure. So 100 State, you know, it is a nonprofit, and it is focused on the ecosystem of startups in Madison and how do we help to get companies off the ground. Within that ecosystem, we saw many of those companies were focused on healthcare. And so we started kind of an incubator to rally those companies together, to bring resources to them, to bring funding and advisors and things like that. And we also realized, as you mentioned, that those companies within 100 Health, they had a common problem, and that was, it was kind of a chicken or egg problem. It was like, if we had data and if we had access to data, we could add a lot of value for health systems and for patients, but the data is really hard to get. So it was essentially a barrier to entry for new companies in the healthcare technology space. And that's where the idea behind Redox came from, was could we actually create an ecosystem where health systems were all connected up under a network, and that data that those health systems have was standardized so that developers can build applications on top of them and bring products into market. And as we were developing 100 Health, that incubator, we were going out and talking to investors and saying, yeah, we have all these companies and we're gonna help them with funding and much like an accelerator would do. And our special sauce was, and we would help them with this technical problem of how do you actually access the data. And I remember we got similar feedback from a lot of investors, but the one that stuck out to me, one investor said, you know, this 100 Health thing that you're doing, it's what I call God's work. And that is, it is important, but no one's ever gonna make money off of it. Which was kind of a shocker for us, because we're like, you know what? That's probably true. There's so much risk when you combine 10 different startups together that it's kind of a long shot for those things to play out. But what most of the investors told us, and what we began to learn and know about ourselves, was that the interface part of it, the platform piece of it, the technology platform, was actually the part that we knew how to do and the part that was actually a scalable company. So we ended up pivoting into that and turned 100 State into 100 Health into Redox in my journey there, and ended up raising money for Redox, which Mark Bakken led the round on, and then HealthX Ventures continued on with us. So yeah, that's kind of how we got into the land of Redox.
We're going to take a quick break and then be back with more Midwest Moxie. You're listening to Midwest Moxie on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, and we're back with Nico Skivoski, co-founder of Redox. Initially, your job at Redox was strategic. You were trying to figure out what investors in the market wanted and drive Redox's response to that. But as it grew, Redox hired good executives, and you actually began to question whether you should even be there. Then the pandemic changed everything. Tell us about that.
At least as I talk to more founders, this is a common issue that they have. It's this imposter syndrome. And at the beginning of a company, I think that founders have to kind of fake it till you make it. And that's certainly what I was doing. But as we grew, we hired these amazing executives, these vice presidents of every department you can think of. And suddenly I was like, well, what the heck is my job? Because we have a marketing guy who can do marketing way better than I can, and a salesperson who can do sales way better than I can, who can run a team, and and so forth. And so I was kind of having this identity crisis of like, well, heck, maybe I should just go and leave and start another company, because I feel comfortable in the early stages of company creation. But at this late stage, as we're scaling rapidly and we have product market fit, I didn't really see what my role was. We were up to about 180 employees going into 2020, preparing for growth that year to double the company from a revenue standpoint. And then the pandemic hit. So Q1 of that year, we realized that healthcare would forever be changed. And what that looked like for us was we probably had 350, 400 projects with health systems, and 75% of them got canceled or paused or delayed because of the pandemic, and that the health systems were saying, well, heck, we don't know what volume is going to look like from a patient load perspective, so we need to pause everything we're doing and prepare for the worst. That was a huge shock to our company, because we had increased our capacity to run those projects, and now we were sitting with way too many people and projects that weren't going anywhere. So in June of 2020, we had to make the decision to actually reduce our workforce and lay off 25% of the company, which was 44 people at the time. And that was certainly the hardest day that I've ever had, the hardest thing that I've ever had to do from a professional perspective, maybe even just generally the hardest thing I've had to do. And it was a trauma that that rippled through the organization that we are still dealing with to this day. And it made me realize that my job wasn't necessarily to focus on how do we rally the troops and how do we actually, you know, execute our strategic plan. My job needed to be to make sure that our team was all right, and basically turn around and look internally at the company and try to make sure that we had a culture that was resilient to shocks like this. Because this by far was the first time that there was any sign that Redox was, you know, not this invincible, you know, fast growing machine that it had been up until that point, for really the first 5 years of the company. So yeah, that's what my job has turned into, is focusing on our culture and focusing on making sure people feel like they have a strong sense of belonging within our organization so that they can bring their whole selves to work. And, you know, we can get the best version of them in their chairs every day doing work for our customers. So that I think is a unique job, that it's uniquely appropriate for a founder because of the history within the organization and the opportunities that we have, really the privilege that I have as being a founder to lead the company in that way. And it's really kind of gotten me back into a place where I'm super engaged within the organization and feeling like I'm doing work that's in my zone of genius, that's, you know, truly unique to me as an individual.
So one of the ways you're trying to maintain this culture, which as we all know is a very difficult thing, you take groups of people, I think you said to me, out into the woods?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a number of initiatives that we do, but one of them is called Camp Redoxy. So someone who works at Redox, they are Redoxy. They have Redoxiness is what we say. And what we do is we take 10 to 15 people once a quarter out into the woods in Boulder or in Austin, depending on the season, and we have a retreat and we get really deep on our values as a company. We really help those folks understand how they can be the holders of the cultural container within the organization. Because the way that I see it is, if you have a strong culture within a company, the culture will hold on to that status quo. So if you add more people to the company, the existing, like the people within the company will hold on to what's good about the culture and essentially ask the new people to try to fit in to the existing culture. So that's the assimilation period for a new employee. But that's not good enough, because what that means is that people have to change who they are when they join a company to try to fit in. And so instead, what we try to do is we take these people, we call them these cultural ambassadors, out to camp. And essentially, they're the cohort of people who I expect to be the sort of heartbeat of inclusion within an organization. So when we add new people, they not only can have a strong sense of identity of what our culture is and what makes it great, but also reach out to the new people and understand what makes them great. Why does the diversity of new people coming in, or I should say, how does that diversity add to the organization and make it stronger? And that's my hypothesis on how you actually make a culture anti-fragile, in the sense that as we add to it, it gets stronger rather than getting weaker. And so those are the ambassadors that we bring out and, you know, have a good time in the woods. But, you know, we get vulnerable and we empathize with each other's positions, and we start to understand why it's so important for this work to be done. And then they go back into their jobs and become stewards of that behavior and that change within each part of the organization. So yeah, it's fabulously fun, as you might imagine, but also just really hard work that I think is important for us to do as individuals and as organizations as we grow into, you know, figuring out what this new type of work is like in a fully distributed fashion.
It's a funny twist. When you were at Epic, you didn't really earn the authority, but had a lot of it. And now you have kind of, talk about that a little. You've earned the authority here, but you don't really have a team, right?
Yeah, so I currently have no team. My co-founder, Luke, is our CEO, and everyone reports to him, and I report to him too. And instead of focusing on growing a team that has a function to do something specifically, what I focus on is our entire team. And all of the individual contributors, all of our management and coaches, and of course, these cultural ambassadors and how we create a culture that's strong. You know, when I think about the early days of a startup, it is really the founders who are laying the vision and doing a lot of the execution, doing a lot of that work. at this stage in a company, the strategy isn't as important. Sure, it's important, but what actually is important is what happens day to day in the trenches when employees are working with the market and with customers and with each other. That's going to determine if our strategy gets executed upon or not. And from my experience, our strategy has never been enough. There needs to be a level of innovation that happens that we cannot predict and we cannot plan for and strategize around. And that requires a level of safety that employees must feel. And so when I look at this work that I'm doing, I believe it's the most important work that I could be focusing on, because it allows our employees to feel that level of psychological safety to make mistakes, to innovate, and to collaborate with each other so that they can actually do more than we could ever imagine. And, you know, hopefully knock our goals out of the park so we can continue growing this company and adding more value.
So one of the tools you've lost in building that culture, in the beginning, one of the motivating factors at Redux was, you know, there are a lot of companies trying to do what we're doing. Let's beat them. Well, you did, right?
We used to be able to rally around beating a competitor. And one of the things that we actually used to say early on is that if we don't do this, someone else is going to do it, and they're going to do it worse. Just because of our experience in the healthcare industry, we're like, ah, if that big company tries to do what we're doing, they're gonna make it all clunky, and they're not gonna use modern web development APIs and all of that. And so that was a big driver for us. And then at some point, and I don't know when that this was exactly, but it always happens in hindsight. At some point, we looked and we said, you know what? There's actually really not competitors trying to do what we're doing right now, and the big incumbents in the space have kind of left this alone to us, and we've essentially won the market and created such a network that we have a moat around our business model that, you know, if you try to start what we're doing now, even if the technology might be better or you're really well funded, you can't really catch up, because Redux has connected up to more than 2,000 health systems now across the country. And each one of those takes time to do. So we have this moat that's protecting us. But there's still so much more we want to do and so much potential we can build on top of that. And so we needed to sort of change the motivation of employees in the company from like having a chip on our shoulder, being the underdog, trying to do this because the industry needs it, to now saying, well, holy cow, look at the potential that we've built or that we have because of what we've built. And what can we do on top of this? And so it's much more of it's a different type of motivation, and it's not based on competition or trying to beat others. It's based on how do we actually add the most value in an industry that so desperately needs it, because, you know, every time you go to the doctor, you can find 10 reasons that technology or 10 ways that technology can make that interaction even better. And Redux gets to empower those technology solutions. And so the better we do, the lower the barriers are for people to actually enter and create those technologies that, you know, can make it easier for you to see your doctor, whether it's virtually now or in person or a combination of those things, synchronously, asynchronously, all of the different ways you might interact with your healthcare system can be enabled on top of the platform that we've created.
Well, and just to be clear, you're not always creating those solutions. You've got the platform, and developers can come on your platform and create an app that makes the health system work better.
Yeah. And I've done a poor job of pitching Redux on this on this interview, but yeah, you're precisely right. It's an API network that developers can build their applications upon and connect up to the 2,000 plus health systems that are already on it. So if you're a developer building an app trying to work with healthcare organizations, we're likely your best bet in getting that app to market in a reasonable in a scalable fashion.
And so what's the potential? One more question, just where can Redux go from here?
Well, so there are endless applications that should be built upon it. There's also different data types that need to be connected to your clinical data. So I'm talking about like claims data or genetic data or pharmaceutical data. These are areas that we haven't really broken into yet that we need to, because if you imagine a world where your clinical history is combined with your genetics and is combined with the data of many, many other patients, you can actually use that data, you know, using data analytics tools to figure out what's the best path for you? What's the best solutions out there? And that's certainly where we're going. And again, we're not building those solutions. We're building the infrastructure necessary for those solutions to exist. And so we're this underlying data platform layer that healthcare innovation is really being built upon.
So the foundation of the healthcare revolution, maybe, huh?
You heard it here first.
Nico, tell us three tips that you have for other entrepreneurs.
Yeah, for sure. So my path to entrepreneurship was through working at working in a job. And I have always thought of my job as sort of loose guidelines around value that I'm adding for the company and value that the company's adding. And so my first tip would be really around thinking of yourself as a steward of value. And you can either do that in a job at a company or as a founder. But if you're thinking about it that way, you'll either become a really valuable employee, a linchpin within the organization, or you'll actually see ways that the company could add more value that they're not focusing on right now, which are opportunities to go and start a company. And so just being really value oriented, I think is a really great way to have an entrepreneurial mindset. So that's number one. The other big thing that I still use in my entrepreneurial career is the local ecosystem that you're a part of. And so my time in Madison was largely spent working with the local entrepreneurs, networking, building that community. And that brought so many opportunities, not only for people to collaborate with, but also funders, like people to actually fund the company, places to actually work, and just really resources within the community that made starting a company so much easier. And third, this is kind of a new one that I've come to realize, but just it's a mindset tip in that starting a company, I'm a cyclist. We have a saying in cycling that it doesn't get easier. You just get faster. And I really love applying that to entrepreneurship because the pain that an entrepreneur feels in their first few weeks of a company trying to figure out what to do with their hands is largely the same as entrepreneurs feel when they have a company of 100 people. It's just bigger stakes. The challenges change. And my co-founder Luke says that running a startup is like playing a professional sport, but the sport changes every year or two. So you start by playing basketball and then suddenly you're playing soccer as the company changes. And so you never really kind of get settled into your job. And so I think you have to have that continuous growth mindset in order to do well as an entrepreneur. And just know that, expect that if it's really hard for you right now, become at peace with that, because it's probably going to be how it will be going forward. And if you're at peace with how difficult it is, then it'll be much more sustainable to actually start companies, run companies.
Well, Nico, thank you so much for joining us. Your story is amazing, and the work you're doing on culture is just really informative.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. It's been fun to share.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Audrey Nowakowski. Join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear from more visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies. That's right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.